from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Chances are, if you're over the age of 30, boys ruled the roost in your high school days. They were the class presidents, captains of the debate team, editors of the student newspaper, valedictorians. The whole town cheered them on at football games. It was good to be a boy. Now, it seems, the tide of prominence may be turning. Girls are rolling up the education system and its accolades, leaving many boys in the dust. Now we hear girls are the new big men on campus. Businessweek magazine explored the phenomenon in its recent cover story, The New Gender Gap, describing a new school order in which girls rule and boys are becoming the second sex. In this hour, beyond parody, girl power and what it means when boys take a back seat. What are you seeing in your school, your child's school? Are boys in a slump? Are girls on a roll? Why? And what does it portend? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Michelle Conlon, working life editor at Businessweek magazine and author of the magazine's cover story, The New Gender Gap. Good evening and welcome, Michelle Conlon.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Thanks for joining us. And with me in the studio tonight is William Pollack, psychologist and author of Real Boys, Rescuing Our Sons from the Myths of Manhood. Good evening and welcome, William Pollack.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Michelle Conlon, you have written at some length and with a lot of color here that you say it may still be a man's world, but it is no longer in any way a boy's. What do you mean by that? What's going on in high school?
Well, what I mean by that is when you look at every metric from reading and writing scores, which are increasingly important in the new economy where communication skills are so important, to AP classes, to student government, you see that boys are falling dramatically behind girls. When you look at special ed, you see that more than 70% of special ed students are boys. When you look at who's on Ritalin, the vast majority are boys. When you look at who's more likely to commit suicide, actually succeed, it's boys. And so from the first days a boy steps into that elementary school all the way up through college, and now even on the master's level, you're seeing boys falling behind.
That's a very grim picture you paint for boys. On the other hand, you say that it seems like girls are building a kind of scholastic Roman Empire along the boys' languishing Greece. So what are the positives on the female
That's
side,
right.
on the girl power there, side here?
There's some amazing positives. I remember interviewing some Intel scholars. These are seniors in high school, and I particularly was interested in talking to the girls. And it's a very prestigious competition. It's a science competition. And I asked them what it was like, and my favorite story is a girl named Casey Vaughn from a school in New York called Lawrence High School near Kennedy Airport. And this is a good high school as a proxy for the nation because it has a wide socioeconomic swath and a big grouping of people represented there. And she told me how girls absolutely ran her school. The president, the vice president, the head of student government, the editor of the newspaper, the editor of the yearbook, the valedictorian. And I said to her, well, are boys ever show up in the leadership positions? And she said, actually, last year, we did elect a boy as class president. This was their junior year. But we didn't think he was doing a good job. And so we impeached him. And when I thought about this, I was really struck because I went to high school in the early 80s. I graduated in 1985, and I went to a small private Midwestern school in Minneapolis. And so this is on point if this isn't just a public schools. Mm-hmm. And when I went to high school, I wouldn't say that girls were necessarily the second sex, but I would say that when it came to who edited the newspaper and who was the class president, all the positions of prestige that you'd love to have on your resume to help you get into college were all guys, and we had a guys' hockey team, and they were great.
You went back to your school in preparation for this story for Business Week. What did you find, Michelle?
What I found was that I was a hockey cheerleader. We didn't have a girls' hockey team. Well, guess what? Not only did the girls have a hockey team now, but they won the state championship. The boys didn't. And the school has had to go so far as to mandate in the middle school that leadership positions and academic honor slots be divvied equally because it was going so much in the girls' favor, and they needed to do something. They really felt like their boys were in a slump.
It's an incredible picture that you're painting. William Pollack, join us here. I mean, it's one of these things that it almost sounds like a kind of media buzz phrase, boys in a slump, girls on a roll. Michelle's got an awful lot of evidence here. Is this a stack of anecdote, or does it really add up to a shift, to a fundamental shift in who's on top?
Well, it's a fundamental shift, and Michelle's absolutely right, and it's real data. But to be on point for a moment, one thing I want to point out is that while girls could still succeed and make it, which I think is a very important thing in our society, it's not required for boys to fall behind for that to occur. And that's something that a lot of people have not thought about.
So you're saying, let me see if I've got you, that there was a gap, that girls have made up that gap, and it doesn't mean that boys have necessarily diminished in their effort, in their performance? Parity?
No, the opposite. I'm saying that boys have diminished, and that, in fact, girls can make up the gap. We could have true girl power. We could have true women's rights without boys falling behind. But we have both. We have girls making up the gap, going beyond, which is wonderful, but boys falling behind not only girls, but their own scores.
So this isn't just the dream realized of gender parity. You're saying the girls have stepped on the gas, they're pulling ahead, and the boys are actually losing momentum. Why on earth would that be?
I wish I had one answer for you, but I'll give you a couple. One is that part of the positive aspects of girl power and girl change, which I think are wonderful, were that we noticed that girls had problems, and we assumed that because it's a man's world, that was a boy's world. And for 10 years, we didn't notice how poorly boys were doing. Over the last 10 years, boys' reading and writing scores have dropped every single year and continue to be below those of girls, between 13 and 23 points in the last scores, 10 points. And you heard Michelle say that those are the building blocks of learning. You'll hear more data later on. But boys are less likely to graduate from high school, less likely to go to college, less likely to get a master's degree, and in some doctoral programs, less likely to go in, 50-50. Part of what's going on is that boys are confused and upset about the gender changes that have occurred, partly because men are upset.
What do you mean exactly by that, confused and upset by gender changes?
That they see girls in a different kind of way. They see the message of the new girl, but they still get the message of what I call the old boy code. In other words, in 2003, not 1953, boys are still told, be stoic, stand on your own two feet, you're the one in charge, mm-hmm. don't ask for any help, don't show your feelings. Then about 10 years later, when they grow into adolescence, they're told, respect girls, give them the rights they deserve, understand them, and let them understand you. Well, it can't work that way. Boys have been shut down. They've been straitjacketed. They've been completely confused. And in fact, they've been told over and over again that it isn't, quote-unquote, cool, as one boy told me in high school, to be smart anymore. That's for girls.
No, wait, why can't it work that way? Why can't boys told to be strong and stand on your own two feet and respect women or girls? What's wrong with that formula?
Well, there's nothing wrong about being strong, but the boy code, which turns off boys' inner feelings, turns off their capacity to be in touch with their empathy and their caring. And I think the kind of world we want to see is the kind of world where girls have moved ahead, girls can express feelings, girls can be successful, but boys can also be successful and show their emotions. But we don't have that kind of parity at all.
Well, this is an incredible picture. I hope I'm not a gender chauvinist when I say I find it a disturbing picture, not in the advances of girls. Bravo, bring them on. But that it should come at the same time as boys falling behind. Michelle Conlon, how did you come to understand in your reporting the context for what's going on here?
Well, one interesting thing, I live in New York, so I spent a lot of time at NYU. I live near NYU. In fact, I live next to an NYU dorm, so I'm sort of immersed in the NYU culture. And I've heard a lot of people say, well, what's so bad about this? You know, no one was making noises about girls 30 years ago. They deserve it. They've worked hard. Go girls.
Yeah.
And we're all for that. But I remember being in a classroom, and it was an undergrad class, and there were 15 girls in that class and two boys. And I talked to all the girls and the two boys about what it was like to be a student at NYU today, where the gender ratio is 60% girls and 40% guys. And I remember one girl saying to me, she was a sophomore, and she said, you know, I went and visited women's schools, Smith, and I decided I didn't want to go to a girls' college. Mm-hmm. And when I got here, I was really disappointed because I feel like I'm at a girls' college. And one thing they said they missed, they almost talked about these lecture halls that looked like female colonies because they were so dominated by women. And of course, not every class like that is at NYU, but they had a few female colonies. And they said they missed having the male viewpoint and the male voice represented in the discourse that was going on in the classroom.
This is an incredible picture. It's incredible. We're talking tonight about girls as the new movers and shakers and boys as the new second sex. What are you seeing in your school, your child's school? Do girls rule? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Rick is calling from Girard, Pennsylvania. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you, Tom. I just wanted to make a comment. As I indicated to the person who answered the call, I gave a lecture at a small, this is in a rural part of Pennsylvania, northwest Pennsylvania, small town of about 2,500 people, and I gave a lecture to the advanced biology class. And when I got ready to give the presentation, which there was 12 students, the teacher, who happened to also be a male, turned to me and says, "What do you notice here?" And they were all girls. And he said, "That's been the trend for about the last 4 years."
This was every single girl in the advanced placement biology class? I mean, every single student was a girl?
Yeah. And he said, "Let's face it, they're going to take over. They are going to rule." And he said it had been a trend like that for the last 4 years.
Wow. Rick, how did the session go? Were these girls eager listeners? Was it a good audience?
Only put one to sleep. Yes, very, very engaged, very active, and all very good students. So.
Well, there's some report from the front and pretty clear evidence. Rick, thank you for your call. I'm still trying to absorb this. Rick sees all 12 girls in an advanced biology class. That makes it sound, Michelle Conlon, like this is earned placement. Is there or was there an enforced piece of this as well? Was this a quota thing, or is this all girls just scrambling up?
Well, I think certainly to borrow Barbara Defoe Whitehead's phrase, she wrote the book, you know, Why There Are No Good Available Men Out There. She's the head of the Rutgers Marriage Project. You know, she refers to this as the Girl Project, which has been the effort over the past 30 years, especially the past 20 years, to really address girls' weaknesses in science and math and to open up the world of possibility to them. Of course, you had Title IX, you had the Gender Equity Act of 1994, and so a legal climate arose whereby discrimination was heavily penalized. And these things really helped girls soar. But I think what Bill Pollack and so many other champions of boys are trying to point out is that's terrific. But just as boys were really losing ground, they sort of fell off the radar screen. And the world was changing because girls' position was changing. And there wasn't a commensurate effort to make sure that things changed for boys as well as for girls. And so they've, in a sense, lost their footing.
I want to continue to hear examples from both of you and from our callers as well. But William Pollack, I'm still trying to understand what's really going on. Are you saying that boys are somehow in a crisis in America?
Oh, I think there's definitely a silent crisis of the boy next door, not just the boy with the AK-47 or the juvenile delinquent, but the boy you know, the boy you love, the boy in your classroom, the boy in your home.
And what are the elements of that crisis?
Well, first of all, we know that boys learn at different rates than girls do. So go to your typical well economically endowed public school, go to your independent school, even go to your inner city school, and you will find that boys are learning the same curriculum that girls do around reading, even though we know from our data that boys will put words together between 16 and 24 months later than girls will. So when you then give them tests of self-esteem about reading, they say reading's for girls because girls do it better. Boys will learn how to write penmanship. And by the way, as someone who's never learned how to write penmanship, I never know why we do that. Mm. But in any case, they learn the what we call praxis skills, the holding skills in their hand to do that, about 14 months behind girls. But we're afraid to use the B and G word around the country. In other words, the boy and girl word. We use the children word.
So you're saying that for centuries and centuries, boys were on top in a really artificial way. Girls then always had the capacity to learn faster, presumably, and you're saying it was just old social constructs that boosted boys ahead of the girls and kept them there, and when you level the playing field, boys are at a natural disadvantage?
We didn't level the playing field. What you did was you gave girls the advantages they deserved, which I think they do and continue to deserve. But then you assume that since boys did well, they would do well in that same playing field, when in fact boys and girls need somewhat different playing fields to both do well.
Wow. I am learning a lot here and have a lot more to learn. Stand by. Michelle Conlon and William Pollack, we're talking tonight about girl power and boys as the new second sex. What are you seeing in your school, your child's school? Do girls now rule? Are boys falling behind? Why? Are boys being ignored, being signaled somehow to shut up and sit down? Are we just reaching a proper gender balance here, or is something again out of whack? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about girls as the new movers and shakers and boys as the new second sex. My guests tonight are Michelle Conlon, working life editor at Business Week magazine, and Dr. William Pollack, psychologist and author of the landmark book, Real Boys Rescuing Our Sons from the Myths of Boyhood. His latest book is The Real Boys Workbook. He's director of the Centers for Men and Young Men at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. You can join the conversation as well. What do you think? Do girls rule in your school? Does girl power change the high school atmosphere? Will it one day change the national culture? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Thomas Mortensen, joining us from Oskaloosa, Iowa. He's senior scholar at the Pell Institute for the Study of Opportunity in Higher Education. Good evening and welcome, Thomas Mortensen.
Good evening.
Tom Mortensen, we're getting our eyes open tonight. I understand that you've got a load of statistics there on what's happening between boys and girls. We want to be sure that we're convinced that this is all for real. Lay out some numbers that show us what's going on.
Well, in the college age range, about 51% of the population is male. And currently, males are earning about 43% of the bachelor's degrees.
That is not in college, but just the college age. So 51% of the population,
but
only 43% of the degree earners.
Yes, the basic demographics are: for every 100 girl babies born in the United States, there's 105 boy babies born.
Okay.
And boys remain a majority of the population up until about age 30, and after age 30, females are a majority of the population.
So boys drop off, but boys or young men traditionally vastly dominated college attendance, and you're saying now they're lagging behind young women.
In 1970, a majority of the bachelor's degrees went to males in every state in the country. By the year 2000, a majority of the bachelor's degrees went to females in every state in the country.
We'll check that box. What else have you got for us statistically?
I think it's helpful to think of this as really a global kind of issue. When one starts to look beyond the boundaries of the United States, about the same thing is happening in all of the Western industrial world, in higher education, that there are many more women enrolled in higher education than there are men. And I think what's going on, I think what's reasonably clear here is that the world is changing, and adult men are in a fair degree of difficulty accommodating the changes that are occurring in the job market. We, out here in Iowa where I live, there are very few men making a living off the farm. And at one point in our nation's history, nearly all men in this country were farmers. Then we went into the Industrial Revolution, and in fact, three-quarters of the employment in manufacturing is male. But since the end of World War II, we've been losing manufacturing jobs.
So, Tom Morton, at bottom, what's your explanation here? Is it primarily economic or primarily cultural? Have we got a situation where when you move out of a clearly male-dominated culture, when you take the foot off the neck of women, they take over? Is that what it means?
I think there are clearly wonderful opportunities in the private service economy that has evolved since the end of World War II, and in particular in the last 30 years. What we find is that men are not adapting to this change, and more importantly, I think the educational system is not preparing boys for the kinds of jobs that are going to be out there when they become men and take their place in families and in businesses and in the world of work. The world has changed, and the educational system, frankly, hasn't. It's done a wonderful job preparing young women. What it has failed to do is to prepare boys for the future as successfully as what we've done for girls.
Thomas Mortensen, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Tom Mortensen is senior scholar at the Pell Institute for the Study of Opportunity in Higher Education. Gabe's calling from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Gabe. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks.
Sure. What's on your mind?
This is something I've done a lot of thinking about. I just graduated from college, and I remember thinking when I was in high school, seeing signs up for the Young Women's Leadership Council,
mm-hmm.
And thinking, you know, why isn't there something like this for guys, I definitely felt like in high school there was, you know, sports, and I went out for wrestling, and that was far too militaristic for me, and I sort of dropped that, and I sort of found myself in college realizing that, like, for, you know, I am an athletic person, but I hadn't been doing any kind of exercise because, you know, I really felt like I didn't want to go for the super competitive sport type thing, and so I started taking a dance class, and it was like this huge new thing for me that I could take dance, and that one of my teachers was not only a guy, but he was straight, which was another huge thing. I really feel as though on my college campus, there were so many girls who would talk about, you know, how guys don't ask them out, how guys are so shy, how women always have to take the initiative, and I just see it all over the place that there's a complete lack of positive role models for males that are sort of, what is it? I guess it really comes down to what's a male feminist, you know? How does a guy sort of behave in such a manner as to respect women and to also stand up as a guy?
So be strong and empathetic at the same time. Gabe, just as a reality check in here, this sounds like it's adding up to you. That are you saying that women were actually, I don't know, more dynamic, more dominant in your high school and college experience?
Definitely in my college. I mean, I think that in all sorts of, I mean, women in my school, the social networks that women had set up were really strong, and girls really took care of each other. And I just didn't see any of that with guys. I don't think that guys knew how to do that. I mean, I think that there's a certain kind of community building and certain kind of support that women have learned, I guess, in the past 30 years, although that's goes beyond my part.
Gabe, you're painting an incredible picture. We thank you for sharing it with us, and thanks for your call. William Pollack, I'm still trying to get at this. Yes. I'm hearing from Tom Morton, from everyone tonight, that young men aren't adapting. But adapting to what? That the world is changing and they're not changing with it? What's the adaptation that's missing?
Well, I put it a little differently, although I agree. I don't think that it's not young men who aren't adapting. It's we who aren't adapting to young men.
We being whom?
We being American culture. Which is to say that boys, we know, learn in different ways than girls do from pre-K onward.
But wait a minute. We were told for centuries that we, being American culture, preferred, gave primacy to young men, that was the culture, a culture that bowed to, lifted up, presumed the predominance of young men.
We gave dominance to young men by suppressing young women. As we opened our doors to young women, which I think is a wonderful thing, we didn't realize that boys would be left behind, not because girls are so much smarter or because we support them, but because we came up with ways of teaching that fit their ways of learning.
That fit girls' ways of learning.
Girls' ways of learning.
And we didn't realize that would be pulling something away from boys, that would be stranding boys somehow?
Right, or realize that it'd be okay to have co-educational environments or single-sex educational environments in which girls learn in their kind of way, and not all girls, I don't want to stereotype this, but many girls learn in their kind of way, which has to do with a more oral, with a more talking kind of early education, and boys would learn better in a more action-oriented, manipulation, movement orientation.
Yeah.
In most schools across America, when boys do the amount of action they need to do, which, by the way, we can harness into education.
You mean physical action, movement.
Right. The average boy up to the age of 10 needs 5 recesses a day. Okay?
Good luck.
He needs what we call an action classroom in which he can play with a computer and, dare I say it, a video game to learn something in a module while his teacher is teaching.
And you're saying girls don't need quite the same thing?
Well, girls can do okay with that as well, but they'll do okay if they don't have that as well.
And so it's not there. Michelle Conlon, let me ask you, in your reporting, did you find that boys were conscious of falling behind? Did they feel like they'd become the second sex? Did they feel like, I don't know, foreigners in their own country? I don't know how to put it.
They did. And even at the sort of top echelon, the very best schools in the country, there was a lot of talk of the payback generation, that they felt like they were the payback generation.
You mean that they were going to have to pay, they were going to have to take the lower rank to pay for the previous generation's supremacy?
Right, to pay for the unfair advantages given to men in the past.
Wow.
And there was also, you know, I think another strain of this is, you know, why is this happening? Is that I think a lot of boys are getting very turned off to education Bill was just talking about this one-size-fits-all classroom that girls adapt to better than boys, where you have to sit for 8 hours and listen, and a boy just goes crazy and then perhaps gets sidelined as disturbed and put in special ed. And well, I remember talking to some college boys, and they were telling me how a lot of their friends just didn't go to school, didn't go on to college because they didn't see the value of it. They weren't interested. And so you say, okay, well, so what? So they have a high school degree. They'll still do okay, right?
Yes.
But that's the big change that's happened in the past 20 years is we've seen the manufacturing sector implode. And, it used to be that you could live in Detroit and go work for GM and provide a solid middle class existence for your family with a high school degree. And now we know that in the new economy, the education premium has never been higher.
Michelle, I want to ask you, as a young woman, when you heard boys describe young men or boys describing themselves as members of the payback generation who were going to be disadvantaged, who, as you describe it, were kind of confused by what was going on. As a woman, did you feel sympathetic to them, or did you feel like, well, turnabout's fair play? Women dealt with this for centuries. Get over it.
I felt very sympathetic to it. And something I noticed before I even wrote this story was this other trend, which pairs up with this trend, which is this trend of women who out-earn their partners or husbands. 1 in 3 women now earn a bigger paycheck than their husband, and that's, of course, projected to grow. And I feel like there's
almost 1 in 3, that's not 2 in 4. That's not half. That's not that doesn't match the demography yet.
It's a third, but it's growing very fast. And so you have this almost sense of kind of a collective identity crisis on the behalf of men, because the roles are getting so switched around and there's a lot of creative destruction societally, which is a good thing, but we don't know how it's all going
to
shake out yet.
This
and that's always an uncomfortable period.
This is so new to me that I can't quite take it all on, but we'll get it piece by piece. I want to welcome to our conversation Cindy Rudrud. She joins us from Glendale, Arizona. She's principal at Cactus High School and president-elect of the National Association of Secondary School Principals. Good evening and welcome, Principal Rudrud.
Well, hello, Tom. Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us. Cindy Rudrud, what do you see in your school? What do you see around the country? Does what we're hearing tonight about the kind of girl power, girls rule dynamic in high schools match up with your experience as a high school administrator?
I certainly see a degree of that here at Cactus High School. In preparation for this evening, I went back and just pulled some data from my files. And just for example, Tom, I'm looking at some of the enrollment numbers in our honors classes and advanced placement classes. And interestingly enough, it's pretty well evenly divided between boys and girls in the 9th and 10th grade in terms of numbers who are enrolled in the honors classes.
Okay.
And then there's a slight shift, but I think it follows what I've heard Michelle say earlier and Dr. Pollack, in that in the 11th and 12th grade, we see advanced placement classes dominated by females by about 20%, a 20% increase in that enrollment.
But a significant percentage. And what about in the sort of tone and atmosphere of your school, Cindy Rudrud? How long have you been a principal, I guess, is a relevant question here.
A very long time.
Okay, a long time. That's good enough.
15 years. I've been in education on 32, so I've got a little bit of – I've been part of that 30-year trend that's
gone
on.
You've got a perspective. You've got a vantage. Then do you feel in the culture and atmosphere of the school, not just in the – goody two-shoes advanced placement class, but in the culture that girls, and I, of course I'm being facetious, kids.
I know you are.
That girls are now somehow more high profile or even dominant in the culture of the school and setting the tone of the school?
Well, I think it's very much accepted by boys and girls, as well as faculty and community, for young ladies, girls, to be very assertive. It's accepted now to be very competitive. The girls on my campus who are athletes are highly competitive, highly successful, well-respected. It's a very positive thing here. And so,
are you worried for boys or not?
Well, I don't think I'm maybe more worried now than I was before this program began.
Oh, geez. Oh, geez.
But I do think there has been a shift in the approaches that we take in classrooms that I would hope not only is helpful to that cooperative learning piece that girls seem to come by a little more easily, but it helps the young men grow in that direction as well.
Oh, so you're saying teach the young men to be more, girl-like in their cooperative...
Well, learning? I think there are some workplace skills where the idea of teamwork and the ability to work toward consensus, those kinds of things are extremely important today. And I'm seeing a lot of that in our classrooms and the kinds of activities teachers are planning.
Cindy Redward, you sound like a great principal. Stand by. Michelle Conlin, William Pollack. We have so many callers who want to join us. I want to turn to them. Krista's calling from Suffolk, Wisconsin. Hi, Krista. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Good. I would just like to make the point. I am one of those girls. I did edit my high school paper, and I'm not going to give you my whole resume, but I just graduated from college.
But it would knock our socks off.
Well, I worked very hard for it, and I'm very proud of it.
Good for you.
But my experience has been, especially in college, I went to a highly competitive, very strong high school. But once I got to college, I experienced more backlash from boys towards that.
What backlash toward your being an assertive, ambitious young woman?
Yes. Yes, and excelling in my classes. And I graduated from Ball State, but the program I was in only had 15 students. So we got to be very close over the course of 4 years. And more I started getting more, oh, well, Krista Honors student is going to go do that. And, oh, well, you know, that kind of thing.
So how do you interpret that, Krista? Is it in high school, fine, but when you got into college, approaching the job market, were these young men beginning to kind of try and get you back in your place?
Yes. That's exactly how I interpreted it, and I think they just didn't know how to handle it. I think that they felt threatened by it and just didn't really know how to react, and that was the outcome.
Krista, stick with us. I see William Pollack shaking his head here. What about that? Because, of course, I'm sure many people are listening tonight and saying, well, fine, but get out into the real world, and men still call the shots. There's still a glass ceiling, yada, yada. Is there something that happens late in the game here where boys, even by intimidation, is almost as Krista describes it, regain an advantage or not?
I don't think they regain an advantage. I think what the caller is describing is that their pain is expressed through anger, intimidation, and dominance, which has historically been the role of boys and men in our society. They don't win as a result. Yes, it's true, it's still a man's world, but you heard Michelle Conlin talk about some of the statistics and figures. We've seen some of that change. But I've heard both boys and girls talk about the pain they feel. The girls, as the caller said, feeling that there's backlash and negativity because she's doing well as a girl. And the boys, when you speak to them, although they do mean and angry backlash things, I'm not saying that's acceptable,
yeah,
but when they really open up through what we call action talk, you really get them aside in a place that's a shame-free zone, mm-hmm, they say, we feel so under the table. We feel so second rate that the only means we have is to, quotes, fight back.
Kind of feedback. Krista, I got to let you go in just a second, but
okay.
Bottom line, here you are, through that high school, through that college. What's the bigger deal now? Are you sympathetic toward boys as disadvantaged, or are you still feeling sat upon by those boys?
No, not at all. I am completely sympathetic to them, and I think I saw Gloria Steinem speak 2 years ago, and mm-hmm, I think she said it really well. She said, we've gotten to the point where we're courageous enough to raise our girls like boys, but we need to get to the point where we can raise our boys like girls.
Wow, Krista, you're big, and we appreciate your voice tonight. Thank you for calling. We're talking about girl power and boys as the new second sex. Are boys in a slump? Are girls on a roll? Will girl power translate into adult success for women? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about girl power and boys as the new second sex. My guests are, in Glendale, Arizona, Cindy Redrud, principal at Cactus High School and president-elect of the National Association of Secondary School Principals. In the studio with me tonight, Dr. William Pollack, psychologist and author of Real Boys, Rescuing Our Sons from the Myths of Boyhood. And from New York City, Michelle Conlin, working life editor at Business Week magazine. Right now, Colleen is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Colleen. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
This is a very interesting conversation, but what strikes me is that, you know, now boys are falling behind and everyone's concerned, and this is just a relatively new phenomenon, but women have been struggling for a very long time to gain a greater market share, a place in the workplace, gain a higher salary. And
fair enough. So are you saying, great, let them eat dust, give women their time in the sun?
Yeah, I say all the more power to women.
There it is, flat out. Michelle Conlin, I'll let that go to you first. Colleen, thanks for your call.
Colleen, you raise a great point. Look at the world. look at billionaires, for example. That's a good marker. Well, 90% of them are men, and only one, Doris Fisher, who helped found The Gap, made her wealth rather than inherited it.
And Martha Stewart is now less likely to become one.
Exactly. Women still make 70 cents of every male dollar, and anyone who's worked in a corporation knows that, of course, sexism is still a huge problem, as is the old boy network. And so it's not to say that there aren't still huge challenges facing women. But here's the problem. Yes, these gains are great for girls. But if boys continue to slide, both boys and girls will lose, as well as society, because we stand to lose a lot of potential and talent from those boys who aren't going to succeed as much as they should. And, you know, it even has effects for things like marriage, because traditionally women like to marry men, you know, soulmates who have sort of the same educational background and earning potential, if not a better earning potential. And what we're seeing is we're creating this whole generation where you have all these girls who are far more educated than boys. And when I interview girls about that, that's not a fun thing. I remember being in New York one night for dinner, and I overheard a conversation at the table next to me. It was two girls in their 20s, and the girl said to her friend, "It's so much easier to make money than to find a boyfriend."
Oh, boy. But, Michelle, I want to ask you, do you see a revolution coming here? If we've got a generation of really hot-ticket girls coming up, but yet the kind of social norms, once you get into the adult world, still appear to advantage men. So don't we have a kind of a mismatch of the next generation of talent and the social structure?
It's going to be very interesting to see what happens, because on the one hand, you know, this could be the female century. All the stars are lining up to make it so. But, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you exactly how it's all going to shake out. But I do think we're going to see some pretty tremendous changes. I mean, at the same time, you know, why is it that there's only a handful of women CEOs of Fortune 500 companies?
You know, why I see a huge disconnect here.
Why is it that we have, less than any other industrialized country as far as female representation in government? I mean, we're still a long way from having parity in the world, and the glass ceiling still very much exists.
Bill Pollack, it is a kind of boy versus girl conflict inevitable here somehow then?
It's not inevitable. I think part of the problem is, and the caller is right, I mean, I agree with her, not that boys should eat dust, but women should experience their time in the sun. Michelle talks about that, and it's still man's world. On the other hand, the real gains that we're trying to seek for women, not just in education, but in their love lives, in their romantic lives, in their home lives, and in their work lives, will never be sustained unless it's both a boys and girls world. It's not a zero-sum game. It's a win-win game. So if we help boys to come back up again, not in a negative or dominant way, but in a way that girls can relate to, then women will start to move up in the workplace and men will relate to them because they have the kind of skills that men also want to have. What men lack in the workplace to a large extent, although they have those paychecks, are that emotional IQ. We pay $10,000 sometimes a day to teach male executives emotional capacity to work in the modern workplace that's been drummed out of them as kids.
Well, maybe the next generation will have it. Cindy Rudd, Principal Rudd, are you going to step out into your school tomorrow with a new sense of the needs of boys, or steady as she goes?
I really do think the point here is we can't afford the loss of talent from either gender.
Certainly, absolutely. We
need to applaud the gains of girls and women, but I think at the same time, and it's been said, we don't want to do that at the expense of the boys. We need both genders developing their potential, and I think, you know, the classroom is where it begins.
Well, we're out of time there, but my eyes have been open tonight. I want to thank all of you, Cindy Rudd, Michelle Conlin, and William Pollack here in the studio. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, On Point movie maven Garen Daly goes to the races. This is On Point. This Saturday, all racing eyes will be on Elmont, New York, as upstate New York native Funnyside attempts to win the 135th Belmont Stakes and become only the 12th Triple Crown winner in horse racing history. It would be the first Triple Crown win in 25 years. The ultimate challenge of man teamed with horse in the race has long been a Hollywood favorite, and if you can't wait until Saturday for Triple Crown Fever, a horse racing film fest might be in order. To take us through the win, place, and show of Hollywood horse racing films, we're joined by On Point's movie maven, Garen Daly, film critic and artistic director of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. Welcome, Garen Daly.
Hi, Tom.
So here we are. Triple Crown's coming up, and Seabiscuit is supposed to be one of the big films of the summer. Horse racing is in the cinema air.
Yeah, it is in the cinema air, and, you know, Seabiscuit, I haven't seen it yet, but the buzz coming out of Hollywood and from the people who have seen it is that this is going to be one of the good family films, and it should be one of the surprises of this summer.
The producers must be rooting for a Triple Crown win to put even more emphasis on horse racing.
It's funny. We seem to be in a new era of loving horse races. It fell out of favor for a while. I remember when I was a kid, I loved watching the Triple Crown. It was a major event. All my brothers would gather around the TV set, and we'd watch Secretariat and Affirmed and all these other great horses try to win the Triple Crown. So if Funnyside wins this coming Saturday, it's going to make a big difference in the box office gross of a film coming up.
So we have a sense of horses and horse racing as having always been around on the Hollywood screen.
Again, we go right back to the turn of the century, of last century, where the cinematographers were out there filming everything, and one of the first things they photographed was a horse running to show that the feet actually left the ground. It went all 4 feet left. That was a very important element in the early history of film.
Without even a narrative, just for the pure enjoyment of seeing what it really looks like when you slow down the run of the horse.
And we have to remember, the horse, as a part of our culture and society, has been very much there. You know, we were an agrarian society up until the 1900s. The horse was the animal that worked on the farm. So there's a real affinity for our culture and the horse. And it really showed a lot of that affinity in the 30s during the economic depression because all of a sudden the racetrack and the horse race became almost symbolic of our chances to get out of the economic depression that we were in. It almost encapsulated our desire to get that quick score, and you could almost win or lose in the mile and a half it takes to run that race.
Garen, walk us through some of the big themes of horses and horse racing in Hollywood.
We have to start with the horse. And in Hollywood, one of the most important elements of a film is defining what the horse is or who the horse is. And in 1937, an excellent film starring Clark Gable and Gene Harlow was Saratoga. And Lionel Barrymore plays the patriarch of a family who tells Clark Gable the entire lineage of his farm's horses.
Look at that! Every one of them championed. There's Ebony Star, the greatest two-year-old of the 90s. Pranced home with a hopeful stakes and her records never been touched. And then there's Blue Bolt, the flying demon by Mad Power. This one's Grandpa. And there's his daddy, Don Barr, the greatest stud in the history of American racing. I bred him and trained him and buried him myself. Yes.
Well, Grandpa, I've forgotten now. Why is it that Don Boy's grave is out in front of the others?
Because Don Boy was always out in front of the others. And that's where he's going to finish, dead or alive.
Lionel Barrymore and Clark Gable in 1937, Saratoga. And there's the lineage, the kind of aristocracy angle of the horse. But in his breeder, the Democratic side, anybody can own these horses.
That's right. And what makes Funnyside so interesting right now is that it's a group of men who are not part of that aristocracy who own this horse, who is probably going to win, or at least I think is going to win the Belmont Stakes. But again, it's interesting. The common person gets involved in this. And that's really important. Anybody can enjoy the horse, win money at the race, or in some cases become a jockey.
Talk about the common people. That's where the little whippersnapper gets up on the back and has to deliver the horse's best.
There has to be a sympathetic relationship between the horse and the jockey. And in 1944, Enid Bagnall's novel, National Velvet, became a movie. And it brought to fore one of our great English actors, Elizabeth Taylor, as a young girl. And what I love about this is that she is a young girl who is going to break the sex barrier because she loves the sport of it. She just wants to get on that horse. She's attached to that horse. She thinks that she can bring the best thing to that horse. When Mickey Rooney finds out, he's not really pleased.
Velvet, I'm going to ask you a question now, and I want you to think it over before you answer me. Suppose I told you now that I found a rider.
I should still want to ride myself. My, I know you're angry, but you'll understand. If you ever rode a horse again, you'd want to win. That's how I feel.
So now it's the glory of winning you want for yourself, isn't that it? You want to ride your race, take your risks and win. You want to win over them all in sight of the world. Velvet brown before the king and queen, is that it? Well, perhaps you're right. Perhaps that's what I'd want if I'd ever ride again. Someday I may get the chance. All right, you ride.
Oh, my, I knew you'd feel. Thank you, my.
What a little pipsqueak voice of the very young Elizabeth Taylor in National Velvet, but she wants to be with that horse. It's not just horse and jockey here, it's horse and girl.
It's horse and girl, and she's breaking a glass ceiling here, which I think is amazing for a 1944 film. She's not only going to be a jockey and running a race as a young girl, but it's a very feminist kind of approach to it, which you don't necessarily see in a lot of horse racing films.
That visceral love of the horse, the great noble beast, is there, though. But, of course, so much of what goes on at the track is about the money that flows behind the horses.
It's about greed. People think that they can make a quick score, that, you know, all they have to do is know the right person or know how to place that bet. And in 1973, George Roy Hill made that wonderful film that brought back Scott Joplin's music, The Sting, and in it he sets up Robert Shaw to place a bet to steal his money.
I'm putting $500,000 on Lucky Down to win third race at Riverside.
Can't lay that off in time. Bet like that could break us.
Not only are you a cheat, you're a gutless cheat as well.
What are the odds?
4-1.
Take all of it.
Into the back stretch. It's Lucky Dan a length. Dr. Twink a half. Walking ahead. I'm a Dreamer by one, followed by...
Sorry, but you couldn't wait. Everything going all right?
You've got nothing to worry about. I put it all on Lucky Dan.
$500,000 on Lucky Dan in the 1973 The Sting, and we're right there in the middle of the story. $500,000 on Lucky Dan.
Yeah, it's Robert Shaw doing a great job. And there's a lot of things about The Sting that I really liked. But one of the films that I'm going to talk about next is a film called Farlap. And what I like about this film is it really reminds me a lot of what's going on with Funnyside.
Farlap, that's P-H-A-R. It's an Australian film.
It's an Australian film. It's a true story about a New Zealand horse that came to the U.S. in the 1930s and was blowing away the competition. An ugly horse. It didn't have the greatest pedigree. The jockey was not supposed to be the best jockey. The owner was a little crazy. Sounds a little like Funnyside, doesn't it? But, you know, what happened is that people started talking about it, and the gambling interests in the U.S. did not like the fact that there was a horse whipping their tushy, and so they start to do a conspiring.
So here we go from gambling to fixing.
Dave, if your horse wins today, get him out of here quickly and have him guarded from here on in.
What are you talking about?
It's just that the big syndicates here have racing pretty well organized. Now, the last thing they want is a horse coming in from the outside who wins everything and can't be bought.
I'll start worrying about that if he wins. But first, he's got to win.
Yeah. Just keep him clear of the pack, that's all. There's a rumor going around that some of the jockeys have been paid to keep him boxed in on the rails. Look, Dave, if something's good, that's okay. But if something's too good... that upsets the whole system. Be careful, huh?
You're in an era of the Matrix and sci-fi. There's something wonderfully organic about the horse. I say to you, I'll be there to watch Seabiscuit with you. That, to me, the dust, the horse, the sweat, the dreams, it's nice and organic. It's down near the earth.
It's also about courage. The beast or the horse, in conjunction with the rider, are physically striving to do something. There are no special effects. It's one-on-one or two-on-two against everybody else. It's life encapsulated in a very short moment.
Well, I'm not a gambling man, but here's a route for Funnyside and maybe a Triple Crown winner this weekend. Garen, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Garen Daly is a film critic and the artistic director of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. He is On Point's movie maven.
I'm picking Valentine, because on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9. But make it effort.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is